This is A Cultural History Of, with Miranda Garrett and Chesky Pechier. Like homework, but drunker.
I'm Miranda Garrett.
And I'm Chesky Pechier.
And we're joined today by film historian Robert J.E. Simpson.
Hello.
And today we're discussing the cultural history of celebrity death.
Robert, can you explain the phenomenon of celebrity death and tell us why you're interested in the subject?
Celebrity death, I think, as we kind of understand it right now, is basically the outpouring of grief or assumed grief or even fake grief, primarily via social media. So Facebook, Twitter, etc., etc., anytime a celebrity snuffs it. My own particular interest is because basically this is how, partly how I earn a living.
You murder celebrities for
money. I have been doing it very discreetly for a number of years now. I've got away I've got away with every one of them. I can't claim responsibility for every celebrity death, but definitely one or two may have been involved with. And I get paid then to talk about it on the radio, which is nice.
What's been your favourite recent celebrity death that you've worked on? That's not a sinister question at all.
I feel I can't answer that question on the grounds that it may incriminate me. In terms of sort of who I recently talked about that I quite enjoyed, the most... I did Christopher Lee a couple of years ago. At that point, I was at a conference in Paris talking about Hammer films, and Sir Christopher Lee had been really important in terms of that company and this work. And basically, he'd been one of the men responsible for giving me work over the years. And to then, he died. We got the announcement during the conference, and I had an international kind of phone call back to Belfast to do a radio piece talking about Sir Christopher Lee while I was in this really weird, strange, surreal environment. Really ensconced in kind of all that work. It meant a lot to me. He was a really important figure. There's always a strange thing with celebrities, particularly if you live somewhere like London and certainly back in Belfast. Occasionally you run into a celebrity in the street and you walk past them. And I've caught myself doing it where suddenly you're saying hello to someone. You think, I know that face. And it's just a hi. And you realise as you walk past, that's not a friend.
And I do someone... that to Bill Nighy on a weekly Bill Nighy stalks me. He's everywhere I go. And he always gives me a cheeky grin.
He's probably thinking exactly the same thing. I know that girl.
She's here again!
Yeah.
But I think we have that, but what social media has... There's an awful lot about ourselves, so we talk about the things that interest us, but I think that there is a tendency to kind of get wrapped up in it, and I think, for me, the blame is very clearly apportioned to certain media outlets. I think the Daily Mail is a pretty good example of kind of... And the Daily Express, the two tabloids that are very clearly structured... manufactured grief.
Who would you most like to do this year? Like,
what level?
It's quite difficult to talk about it, isn't it, without making it sound like Bob's a murderer.
It's out there. I'm just a sexual deviant. I don't know. It's very hard to.
I mean, the Queen's coming up, surely.
Oh,
she is. I don't think I'd want to talk about her. I don't think I'd want to do a royal ever, with the possible exception of Prince Charles, who I think is quite interesting in terms of some of the kind of the figures that he knew and was friends with. If you've ever seen his impressions of things like Blue Ball from the Goon Show, you know.
What about Prince Michael of Kent? He's my favourite royal.
I don't know. It's weird. I'm not a kind of. I don't think the royals really interest me. I don't feel that they greatly affect what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis. I don't feel that there's someone I look towards.
Would you not want to go on a night out with Prince Michael of Kent?
I was going to say, does Prince Michael of Kent really affect Miranda on a day-to-day basis?
I love
him. He's in the garden again.
With Bill Nighy.
Bill Nighy I would talk about, because he's someone who's quite interesting, but I don't want Bill Nighy to die this year.
I don't think he will. Will he?
I don't know.
I mean, I see him weekly and he looks fine.
Could anybody have said George Michael was going to die at the end of last year? No. That kind of came a little bit out of the blue, and that often is also where you get these things that are quite interesting. Somebody who's on the verge of a career renaissance, who's maybe been quiet for a while, so they're coming back and they're starting to talk about projects. There's a little bit of a buzz going about them, and then, you know, particularly when they die. You know, I remember being in London just after Michael Jackson died and going around to the O2 and to look at the bodies exhibition. But obviously there was a huge big tribute thing outside where all the fans had kind of carved into the walls and done things. And there was this kind of thing there. When Bowie died last year, I was back in London again and kind of seeing the Bowie tributes. And there is this kind of... that's interesting because these guys are just about to do these big projects. There's a much more... public awareness, I think, and then some of those big figures.
People are already thinking about them in that moment.
Do you think, though, it's maybe that the fact that they're doing a big project contributes to their death because they've been retired for so long, having a nice, relaxing time doing the gardening, and suddenly the pressure, off they pop?
I think it's I don't know that it necessarily applies to the pressure and stuff, but certainly it makes us more aware. I think it's a better story for the newspapers as well, whenever you can say, oh, this is so tragic, look at this great thing they've done to him. Bowie has just released an album on his birthday 2 days before, and it's like, suddenly he's very much in vogue, and then he's gone, you know, and we're kind of like, what the fuck? When Prince died, there was kind of a build-up to that one. You know, we kind of watched him going back and forth to pick up his drugs because he was not a well man. Suddenly he's gone as well. The likes of TMZ are particularly bad at doing this. When Carrie Fisher died at the end of the year, you know, obviously there's a big buzz about Star Wars. She'd just been doing Catastrophe back in the UK. She'd done a book tour around here. And just that moment, there's kind of a real awareness of those figures. But they're also, those are also really big cultural figures.
I was going to say, just hearing you list them like that is... made me realise a lot of people died in 2016. It really was a
what's your take
crop.
On that, Robert? Is that as the or do you think year that's just of celebrity perception? Death?
I think last year was the year of celebrity death, because you look at the 3 months we've had this year so far, we haven't had anything like those big name figures at all. And last year there was a number, and they were quite regularly popular. Now, I know a number of news outlets did do analysis about their obituaries, about their content, about what they'd done in relation to other years. Certainly there are always significant figures. I mean, the Times managed to find three people to kill every single day for their obituary columns.
Was it particularly cold?
I don't think Bowie died of a chill.
No.
But it kills old people, doesn't it? When they have a cold snap.
It does, and you tend to get more deaths in the winter, but we didn't. But it wasn't just a winter phenomenon. It was one that ran right throughout the entire year. And I think it was a weird kind of phenomenon, because when you looked at the year before that, this year, we just haven't had the same way. I haven't heard people kind of going, you know, oh, and please not another one. No, there hasn't been that same kind of buzz. And there was barely a week went by last year where you didn't have some sort of figure. Even if you didn't know who they were, you were very aware that there'd been another figure that had shuffled off this mortal coil.
I mean, people were all scared that Attenborough were going to go, weren't they?
Well, I'm still worrying about that.
Miranda and I have both done some research and have come up with some interesting facts about the cultural history of celebrity death.
We're going to pitch them to our guest in three rounds, historical, cultural and social.
And at the end of the three rounds, Robert gets to choose whether Miranda or I have been more interesting and crown the winner, the cultural historian of the month. And we're going to start with historical.
Okay. I am going to kick off with Rudolph Valentino and the death of a heartthrob. Thousands of rioting mourners, heartbroken female fans attempting suicide, wild cause of death rumours. You might think I'm describing popular mass hysteria after the death of Presley or Lennon, but I'm not. This all happened after the 1926 death of Italian actor and sex symbol Rudolph Valentino. This wasn't the first time a famous heartthrob had died, but it was the first time it had become a public spectacle. Valentino died in New York, aged 31. Mourners rioted, smashed windows, and fought with police to get a glimpse of the body. Fascists, allegedly sent by Mussolini, guarded the coffin. They were actually actors hired by the funeral home. The press went wild. There were stories of fans committing suicide, rumours that the cause of death had been a heartbroken lover, and reports that the funeral home secretly replaced the body with a mannequin. 100,000 mourners lined the streets for his funeral. Pola Negri, Valentino's former lover, collapsed beside Valentino's bier, where she'd conveniently installed a massive flower arrangement spelling her own name. But the story doesn't end there. For decades, each year on the anniversary of his death, a mysterious veiled lady in black appeared at Valentino's tomb and left a single red rose. Valentino's second wife, Natasha Rambova, wrote a book about her life with him and how she believed his spirit would contact her. Most excitingly, there were stories of a cursed ring bought by Valentino in San Francisco and allegedly worn by him at his death. Since Valentino's death, the ring has been claimed as responsible for at least four subsequent deaths. Valentino's ghost is said to haunt several locations throughout California, and some psychics say it's looking for his cursed ring. It's quite spooky.
Well, I've got a little bit of an overlap with yours because I wanted to talk about destination cemeteries.
Ooh!
So I was thinking about Oscar Wilde's grave at Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris.
Been there.
That visitors come and they cover it in kisses. And Marilyn Monroe's in Westwood Village Memorial Park, which is also covered in lipstick. Marilyn Monroe's grave caused a bidding war that ran into the millions to claim the spot next to her. But recently I visited the really over-the-top Hollywood Forever Cemetery in Los Angeles, the only cemetery in Hollywood and the final resting place of Douglas Fairbanks, Mel Blanc, Jane Mansfield, Mickey Rooney and Rudolph Valentino.
Yeah.
It was founded as the Hollywood Memorial Park Cemetery in 1899, long before the movie industry, and it sort of developed alongside it so the stars would all get buried there. It's really dramatic as a cemetery. It's covered in palm trees, crazy tombs and statues, such as Johnny Ramone's that has a full-size statue of him on top of it, or the director Cecil B. DeMille, who is buried in one of his own set pieces, a massive stone sarcophagus from his movie The Ten Commandments. The cemetery has a checkered past. The 80s owner William Roth was sued on several occasions for not maintaining upkeep and for letting the film studios use part of the graveyard as a car park. Since his death in 1998, they now run tours there. They have a film festival there. It's The Flaming Lips recorded a video there. It's become a destination in its own right. It's relatively unhaunted, which I'm surprised at. The main ghost that there's rumoured to be there is
Rudolph Valentino,
who it's said can still be seen making his way through the exit to the Lemon Grove Film Studios, and his own ghostly fan, the aforementioned ladies in black who leave roses. These may have a very innocent explanation. Maria Watson came forward and said she was the lady in black, and that she visited him yearly. But several other people have come forward since saying that they were the lady in black. And now they hold a yearly Lady in Black ceremony party around Valentino's grave where women and men appear dressed in the veil and throw roses over it.
I've actually heard the most convincing claim is someone called Dietra Flame, and she got sick when there were loads of imitators and gave it up after about 30 years.
Mm.
She didn't fancy it anymore.
Robert, do you have any questions about Hollywood Forever or Robert Rudolph Valentino?
You've been making notes, which I've been very impressed about.
I have been making notes, yeah. Well, I see, I'm one of those people who likes to go around the graveyards and haunts and kind of find... I've paid my pilgrimages to a number of sites. I mean, you mentioned Père Lachaise.
Yeah, I was going to say, you said yes, you've been there. Did you kiss the grave of Oscar Wilde?
You can't really do it anymore.
Really?
When I first visited, you could, and the stone was all very, very carefully covered in kiss marks, but now they've put up a protective glass coating on the outside because the kisses were actually deteriorating the stones.
Oh, wow.
So
it's very unhygienic as well.
Well, it is. I mean, I sat there and I watched, and people do still kiss the glass, and you kind of see all these lipstick marks, and it's a weird kind of pilgrimage.
Is that's the one where his tomb looks like a penis?
I think the penis disappeared many years ago. It's like a huge sort of angel thing it's quite tall. The other one in that graveyard is Jim Morrison.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim Morrison's grave has similarly suffered from the graffiti that people have done. There was a bust of him for many, many years on top of the grave as well that went missing, so somebody stole that. There's this kind of morbid fascination with these graves and this desire to own something of them, even in death. One of my many kind of Facebook friends actually runs a group in America where they go around and they do the tours around Hollywood. And they're quite into the morbid culture of sort of death artifacts as well. So it's definitely something I have an interest in. I know I'm one of those people. Rudolph Valentino, I don't know. He's not kind of... I'm not that bothered about him.
I
had a question about Valentino.
Yeah.
So I take issue with Valentino being the first public spectacle of outpouring of mourning.
I think that was more the first heartthrob.
Right, death. Okay. Because I was going to go with Caesar.
One of my favourite historic funerals is the Duke of Wellington's, and I think that's particularly interesting because he became so deeply unpopular as a conservative politician in the final years of his death that everyone was absolutely sick of him. But then when he died, he had the biggest procession that London had ever seen.
But is there not a temptation to do that anyway? I mean, you look back into the Roman literature and they did have professional mourners that came out who were paid to just sit there and cry. And the more people you had doing that, the more of a kind of demonstration it was of your wealth and of your class. I kind of feel that that's what we still kind of do. And so...
If you think of something like Michael Jackson's funeral that was televised and there were people there, they were almost just trying to outdo each other with how extreme... the grief was. It was just like a Roman spectacle. They'd have loved it.
Absolutely.
Ovid would have been all over that.
But I think it's also kind of part of the weird fandom about all these things. And I think, you know, Valentino, Caesar, there is a kind of fandom about each of these kind of figures. And perhaps it's an element of just that showing off. It's like, I'm the bigger fan because look how sad I am and look at all the things. And I think that's also part of the reason why we do get a little bit obsessive on social media. We're trying to outdo each other, all our friends. It's like, oh, this music meant so much to me. I'm devastated. It's like, well, actually, no, this meant more to me back in because I'm 10 years older and I listened to this when I was 5.
The cultural history of overthinking things since 2016.
That was historical. Moving on to cultural, Robert, I'd like to tell you about The Beautiful and the Dead.
Ooh.
So it's very Hedda Gabler to think about beauty and death. And I decided to look specifically at sexy embalming of celebrities. The most perfectly embalmed were not famous in life, but their post-mortem beauty has brought them acclaim. In particular, I like the 1920s mummified 2-year-old Rosalind Lombardi, who's so perfect she's called the Sleeping Beauty because she appears to blink her eyes. Really creepy. Mm-hmm. Worth a look. However, we only want people really who were famous when they were alive. So alongside the preservation of Cromwell, Jeremy Bentham, Sons Head, and Lenin... you have Evita Peron, who was in fact embalmed twice. Once immediately after her death and again in 1974. As Tomas Eles Martinez says in his novel about her corpse, Santa Evita, no other corpse has meant so much to a nation than Eva Peron's to Argentina. Evita's body was first smuggled out after her death by the military, who feared that the sight of her corpse would rally the working classes. Because 2 million people had gone to see her original embalmed body lying in state. They had a really hard time hiding the body. They initially hid it in some military offices, but mourners kept leaving flowers and candles, tipping everyone off. They swapped it with wax doubles, hid it in a cupboard, and eventually interred it under a false name in Italy. Her missing body became a symbol for the resistance. You'd see graffiti in Buenos Aires saying, "Where is the body of Evita Peron?" Later, when the body was repatriated, they decided they needed to restore it for display. And Domingo Telecha was approached in a bar by hired thugs and threatened that he had to do the most perfect job on the body of Eva Peron. The body had undergone a great deal of damage. It had lost fingers because the military had wanted to verify it was the remains of Eva Peron. Some sources said that it looks like it had been repeatedly hit, punched in the face. It's also been stored standing up, which had really damaged the feet, and it had been squashed into far too a small coffin that had damaged the nose.
Ew.
However, the job that Domingo Telecha did was so good that she looked exactly like she was asleep. She looked absolutely perfect. And when she was eventually moved to be buried with her husband, it was said that the true reason for them having to move her was because the curator fell in love with the corpse and kept trying to sleep with it.
So how did he do that? What methods did he use?
They know what was used, the chemicals, but no one knows exactly how it was done because really good embalming is such a skill that people won't write down the exact technique. So people are still trying to recreate it. Because in America, bodies are still usually embalmed before burial.
Usually?
Yes.
Why?
It's common practice.
Because they're viewings.
Yeah, because there's much more open caskets, yeah.
You can do drive-through viewings of dead people in the States.
Oh, I thought it was a Catholic thing.
No, not at all. No.
And Carla Valentine has written a lot on this, on the different methods of embalming and sort of mysterious things. There's a famous mannequin in a shop that people aren't sure if it's a body or not.
It's all very House of Wax, really, isn't it?
It's all very House of Wax. Come, Randa, come at me. What you got?
Right,
is it better than a sexy corpse?
Yeah. But similar, in a way, to living on in the afterlife. I'd like to talk about what happens when an actor dies halfway through filming a movie.
Ooh.
Mm. Often, special effects are called upon for a kind of cinematic celebrity resuscitation, which is a phrase I've coined, and I'm now calling it that. This is nothing new. Body doubles and a cardboard cutout were apparently used to cover Bruce Lee's death in the 1978 film Game of Death. But what I really want to talk about is how, thanks to CGI, this kind of posthumous performance is getting more common. The archetype is 1994 fantasy action film The Crow, in which lead actor Brandon Lee was accidentally killed on set, and he was replaced by the final scenes by another actor onto whom a digital reconstruction of his face was grafted. More recently, Universal Pictures combined CGI and previous footage for Paul Walker's role in 2015's Furious 7 after his mid-filming death in a car crash. This kind of celebrity cinematic resuscitation has generally only been employed as a last resort after an unexpected death. But it's becoming more routine. Audrey Hepburn died 24 years ago. Last year, she starred in a Galaxy chocolate commercial. This year, Rogue One broke new ground by giving a significant supporting role to a dead star. A digital embodiment of British actor Peter Cushing, who died in 1994, and reprised his role from the original 1977 Star Wars film as Grand Moff Tarkin. I haven't actually seen any Star Wars film, so none of that means anything to me, but other people I know are interested. How are living actors responding to this ethically dubious trend? It does vary. Some are taking precautions to steer their legacy with stipulations on how their images are used, so no sex, drugs, violence, or by forbidding their use completely. Robin Williams banned any use of his image for commercial means until 2039, according to court documents. Others are totally embracing it. So according to special effects experts, some actors are now starting to stockpile digital 3D replicas in themselves so they can keep appearing in movies after death. And I'd like to imagine be the first to win the Oscar for Best Posthumous Performance.
Mm. So they did that in Queen of the Damned, didn't they? Queen of the Damned, it was Aaliyah who died in the plane crash.
Oh, yeah.
And it was really early CGI, but the main problem they had was the voice.
Yeah.
And the voice of her in that is her brother, because that was they used her brother and then digitally manipulated it. And I've not seen that film since about 97, so I don't know how well that stands up.
Well, I quite like some of the older ones. So in The Pink Panther, the trailer of The Pink Panther, Peter Sellers, they just covered a body double in bandages and just went on with it.
It's Roger Moore for part of it. What they've done.
I love it.
They cobbled together elements of outtakes from some of the other films and put them together, and then they have another character who loosely kind of follows it through. But yeah, they kind of had to be very delicate in how they got around that one. It was a cheap, nasty effort in the Pink Panther franchise. And David Niven is also voiced by somebody else in that, because David Niven was very, very ill.
Yeah. I think this is a good question for you, Robert. So which dead actor would you now like to be CGI recreated and put in a starring role?
Valentino, obviously.
I don't think I would necessarily want one to say. Now, Rogue One was interesting with Peter Cushing, whose voice is a problem in it because it doesn't sound like Peter Cushing. But seeing Cushing on screen again is great, and he's another Hammer actor, so again it's kind of a nice little thing for me. I thought it was a good effort. You didn't mention Oliver Reed in Gladiator.
No, but I've got it in my notes here though, so I could have done.
You could have done. He was
Oliver Reed's dead.
He's been dead about since 1998.
Yeah, like a good long time.
Yeah, but in 2000 in Gladiator, they finished him off with CGI.
Well, they didn't finish
it. That's how they finished it. That's how he done it.
But an even earlier example is look at Ed Wood's Plan 9 from Outer Space, where he used a tiny couple of minutes of Bela Lugosi, who had shot basically coming in out of a doorway, and then covered him for the rest of the film with another actor who basically spends the entire time with a cape around his face, so you see the eyes. This is, and the film came out, I think, about 3 or 4 years after Lugosi had actually died.
Mm.
So, as a precedent, I mean, it certainly exists 50-odd years ago. They have genuinely been trying to do this for a long time. And I don't know. I mean, when it's an instance like Paul Walker, that film costs so much money already.
And they've already consented to being in it then, really, haven't
they?
Yeah,
yes. And they brought his brother on to kind of stand in for him, which I thought was a nice touch.
Two of his brothers, apparently.
I mean, that's nice. You can kind of see the family's on board with that. Peter Cushing's a bit... A lot of people are a little bit dubious about that.
There are definitely ethical issues with that, aren't there?
Carrie Fisher's in that as well. Now, she wasn't dead at that point, but the Carrie Fisher they have on screen is not Carrie Fisher today. It's Carrie Fisher CGI recreation, so that they do it. There are certain television programs that are made at the moment where they will CGI scan the performers in order to digitally use them later on, and you do sign away your rights to your likeness.
What, do who does that?
I cannot say.
Oh.
But
I shouldn't have chosen this one because you know too much about it. Clearly a specialist.
Well,
in
we
subject.
Don't know about how much he knows about embalmed celebrities.
Yeah.
Embalmed celebrities is quite interesting. Yeah, I mean, I did have my questions about that one. I've certainly gone to look at mummies and things mm-hmm. in the past. Mm. I'm fascinated by the idea of Lennon in a cage.
Oh, Lennon. Here's an interesting thing I like about Lennon.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously that's a really good bit of embalming as well. He's really good.
Mm-hmm.
Lennon's suit was meant to be changed every year. So he stays in fashion.
Oh, that's adorable.
But since the fall of the Soviet Empire, they only do it every 5 years.
Oh.
And I just feel that's quite specific. It's like, we won't yeah. not do it, but we don't need to do it every
I'd
year.
Love to be in the meeting when they thrashed out how the often detail. They were going to do that.
And who plan. Gets that job? Do you know, yeah. who dresses Lennon?
Oh.
And did you know about the embalming of Jeremy Bentham? Because that's,
oh,
well,
that's one of my favourites.
No,
yeah,
I
you can
know
still
that.
Go and see him.
Right.
He's still in UCL, isn't it?
He's in UCL.
Yeah.
Well, that's my plans for tomorrow then.
It's not his head, though, because students stole his head and played football with it.
Wow.
So it's a fake head, but it's very creepy. He's just sat there in the case. And the thing that I read literally yesterday on Twitter was, it says, Bentham welcomes visitors. And I was a bit, well, he doesn't have a choice, does he? He's dead.
But he did. He requested that he was put on display. But I think that's an example of where it slightly backfired a bit, because people just know him because he's that dead guy in UCL. And no one really remembers that actually he was a philosopher and did some good stuff.
Yeah, this in a way kind of, for me, seems to go back to sort of the Victorian practice, whenever they're kind of pickling bodies as dissection and things is more and more kind of explored.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of think of Frankensteinish elements, like if you go to the Surgeon's Museum in Scotland or something.
Or
the
Surgeon's Museum in London, full of pickle people.
The Hunterian, one of my favourite museums.
And it's fascinating.
Currently closed for restoration though, real shame.
Oh, so I mean, it's like even, you know, I remember sitting at school and looking at things in jars and fetuses and things. So, I mean, we have this fascination with the idea of preserving the bodies anyway and looking at them. It's just a little bit more interesting when it's a celebrity, and it's kind of disappointing that more celebrities don't have themselves pickled. So
well,
we can
it's
go
kind of been
them.
Overtaken by cryogenics, hasn't it? So you're much. If
we
you're,
can't go look at the bodies if they're cryogenic.
No, but that's what I'm saying. If somebody wants to live on,
mm.
whilst in the 19th century they would have had themselves, or even the 1920s, they would have had themselves embalmed, or you're more likely your family would have you embalmed because they want you to live on.
Mm.
Now, if you've got that much money, because that sort of level of embalming is not cheap, you'd be more likely to be cryogenically frozen.
Or, and is cryogenically freezing now being replaced with CGI and digital scanning?
Well, no, because you're still dead, aren't you? Cryogenics, the whole idea is,
but
you've
still got a
voice.
And you kind of have to be dead before they cryogenically freeze you.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
which option would you go for?
What, cryogenically or embalming?
Yeah.
I suppose if I could afford it, I might consider the cryogenesis because I like the idea that there's a chance I might get brought back. Although I have seen karaoke and Cold Lazarus, the Dennis Potter plays, and if you watch those, the kind of the prospects, it's kind of like a Futurama element where, you know, if you get brought back hundreds of years from now, it may not be that pleasant for you. Your head pickled in a jar and no control.
Yeah.
It's kind of what I suspect would happen to me. Embalming, you kind of have all your fluids taken out and they place it with something else, and you definitely aren't coming back from that.
I personally would see that as a bonus. I don't think I'd want to come back.
I think I'd rather be CGI scanned, and but then I think you've got control over the memory, and I think you then can. Oh no! There's a fascinating prospect of having, you know, 3D models made of your
pornography.
Yeah, that's where it's going to go, isn't
that's
it?
What I was thinking. Pornography.
I mean, considering you already have things like, you know, the flashlights and stuff that you can get the model on people's.
We are living in the teledildonic age.
Yeah, we are.
So the next step surely has to be have the entire body done. A bang on replica.
Or you could just have sex with the embalmed corpse, like apparently Evita suffered.
I appreciate the listeners can't see the look of shock and disgust on my face. I'd rather have one that's still wriggling, thank you very much. Ideally, not with worms.
So we're now moving on to the social section, and I'm going to be talking about celebrity death pools. The death of a celebrity, generally a time of sadness, but what if the event has made you some money? For as long as there have been celebrities, there's been gambling on when they'll die. For example, apparently in the 1400s, speculation on the death of the Pope got so out of hand that it had to be banned. The 1998 Clint Eastwood movie, The Deadpool, in which Dirty Harry was working against the clock to stop a pool where celebrities become murder targets, inspired the modern incarnation of celebrity death prediction, the celebrity death pool. The concept is simple. At the beginning of the year, you pick a slate of celebrities, usually 10, that you think will die that year. When one of your picks kicks the bucket, you score points. At the end of the year, the player with the highest number of points wins the pot. So I'm going to talk to you a bit about how you can get involved. seems to have ended up acting as a weird spokesperson for celebrity death pools now. Some of the most popular websites are thedeadpool.com, stiffs.com, and my personal favourite, cashforcadavers.com.
Amazing.
That's an actual website. You can go on it.
Is that like cashforgold.com?
You might also want to check out Thomas Valente's very comprehensive 2011 book on the subject, which claims, amongst other things, to show you how to use worksheets and formulas to organise and select your list of candidates. Unfortunately, the book is currently unavailable on Amazon. One of the best resources to help you pick your candidates are websites like thedeathlist.net. This describes itself as a list of 50 celebrities selected by an expert committee for their likelihood to die during 2017. And two of their 2017 predictions, Joost van der Westhuizen and Mary Tyler Moore, have already proved correct. So I'd like to discuss, after we've heard Chesky, who our own celebrity death picks for 2017 are going to be.
So you don't know, have you seen who's number one? Do they have sort of a ranking?
They do on the death list, yeah.
Oh, do you know who's number one?
I do, yeah. Do you want to know?
I would really like to know.
So on the death list at the moment... any guesses?
Ooh, the Queen
for number one. No.
The Queen died before Christmas. Did you not hear? No, there was a whole.
She's been a dummy. They've just been holding her up, making her wave.
There was a speculation for a while before Christmas that the Queen had died.
She was already dead, replaced by a robot like David Attenborough.
That's why she hadn't been in. Remember, she was ill.
Oh, because she was ill.
She was ill.
Oh, yeah. And they couldn't kill her over Christmas.
Oh, Prince Philip.
Prince Philip is on the list. He's not number one. For each of them, it tells you what their profession is. And Prince Philip is described as a casual racist. Number one is actually Kirk Douglas.
Yeah. He has 100.
He's very old.
Number two, Vera Lynn, which would fit in nicely with your theory that they often die when they've got a new project. No, she's got a new album out. Dennis Norden's also on the top 10.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so that's something to look forward to. And Olivia de Havilland.
Joan Fontaine's sister.
Did also think she was dead as well.
Joan Fontaine's dead, but Olivia's still around. And also approaching the centenary, I believe.
Ooh. Who were your picks, Robert?
For this year?
Yeah.
I think Attenborough's still within a good
chance.
Can
we stop talking about that?
No.
It deeply upsets me.
The Queen. Mm-hmm. I think it's just of that age.
I think the Duke of Edinburgh is more likely to go than the Queen this year.
Would you a rock star? It's picking a rock star that's quite.
What about Mick Jagger? He's ancient.
No.
He's not that ancient. He's only about 70.
Chuck Berry has a new album coming out.
Oh, yeah. New album. Really
he's just turned 90. New album's out.
And to be fair, I thought he was already dead, so.
If you've seen him perform live in the last 10 years, it feels like he is.
So, Chesky, what are you going to come back with?
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit more that we alluded to in the introduction of the mass hysteria of grief at the death of a celebrity. And I want specifically to look at two women. Both who I'd say were largely famous for being famous, Princess Diana and Jade Goody. These deaths both produced a mass manifestation of mourning that before, especially Diana, would have seemed really at odds with the British stiff upper lip way of looking at things. And so since her death, that kind of extreme emoting is known as the Diana effect. At the death of Princess Diana, there were 10-hour queues to sign condolence books. There were so many flowers that there was such horror from the public that they were going to be destroyed that a rumour was published that they were actually being airlifted to one of Richard Branson's private islands where they would create a shrine to Diana. That did not happen. They were cleaned up by Boy Scouts. In his paper, Beneath the Mourning Veil, Mass Observation and the Death of Diana, James Thomas argues that this was in fact not the uniting of a nation under extreme grief, that this wasn't a genuine outpouring of emotion, but a very vocal minority drowned out the masses. For example, still more people watched Coronation Street that week than watched any coverage of Diana's death.
That's so interesting.
And there was actually a lot of protests and people writing in saying they wanted their normal TV coverage back and they didn't want to watch all of this. So the mass mourning was instead something curated and encouraged by the media, who then afterwards seemed to be quite embarrassed by what they had done and to almost be realising that it was over-sentimental and mawkish. And you see this when reality star Jade Goody died. So Jade Goody's death, in particular, I think, because she died, whatever she was or wasn't, because she died of cervical cancer at an age where women weren't screened for it, got a lot of media attention. It was even mourned by Gordon Brown in Parliament. He brought it up as an example of why you should start testing young women younger. But rather than conclude or encourage any sort of national mourning, the British press deemed that Goody was not worthy. And there was a particularly nasty bit in The Independent that said she was a chav, a racist, and even a pig who'd embraced herself as a worthy victim, and that she'd gone from, that we must not see her go from national disgrace to national treasure. So she had taken, according to the press, this Diana effect too far, because she was looking for a redemption in her own demise. But what I think is interesting is, I think this is the media being critical of itself, that in criticising poor old Goody, who just died, they were criticising themselves for creating this canonisation of celebrity in the first place. She'd just taken it to the extreme. She was trying to make as much money as she could before she did die. At one point she said she would even televise her own death.
Very interesting. I didn't know that about Coronation Street. Oh, isn't it? It's one of those things, isn't it, that everyone says you can, everyone can remember where they were when Princess Diana died. I can't. Can you guys? Can you, Robert?
I woke up. I flicked on the television set. It was quite early in the morning. I was in my room at home. Would have been 16. And the stuff that I wanted to see was not on the telly box. Instead, there was all this weird reports about Princess Diana died and Prince Charles was on the way to Paris. And it was very surreal. August 1997. So it's 20 years this year, which is weird. So I remember watching it a bit, but being more frustrated and being very thankful that I had a video recorder and I could stick on my own tapes of something else.
You just wanted to watch Coronation Street.
No one watched Doctor Who, to be fair.
Can you remember?
I don't remember her death. I remember the funeral. Mm. And I particularly remember the funeral because there was a car in the funeral that was the same car as we had at home.
Oh.
And when it was driving along.
Yes.
No, it was... no, it was one of the guard cars. And our car was called Reg. And when that car came on, my dad went, "Oh, look at Reg, isn't he proud?" And in my sort of 10-year-old head, I decided that that was our car. And I told everyone at school that our car had been at the funeral of Princess Diana. So I didn't quite care. And I also thought the guard with the white stick was blind.
There was a paper I read by Peter Gosch called Media and Immediate Mourning, where he argues that, in fact, the mass outpouring of grief to Princess Diana was less about her as a person and more of a moment where the British populace had this moment where they were anti-monarchy. They were sort of united in a moment of being anti-monarchy because they were angry with the Queen and Prince Charles because they felt she'd been mistreated. And then when Blair came on and did his sort of weepy people's princess thing, it was a moment that people sort of all went, yeah, actually, no, we're pissed off about this. And that kind of allowed them to be over-emotional. But what I think's more interesting than that, there's so much written about this mass hysteria moment, but not the then retraction of the embarrassment. Because as much as we say, oh, yes, it was the tabloids, Daily Express, Mail, the Times was well on board with this. You know, they were well on board with the People's Princess narrative. Mm. But anything you read about it now and when a famous person dies is, oh, we don't engage in that kind of... If you look at the sort of coverage of Michael Jackson's funeral, it's very, this is disgusting, this is crass.
But American, we'd say now, wouldn't we? Whereas we started it with Princess Diana or the Duke of Wellington.
I do think there's also a fascination with it. I mean, so someone you alluded to very, very briefly earlier was looking at Elvis's funeral. So whenever he dies in exactly 20 years before Princess Diana, almost in August 1977.
I love that you know that.
August 16th, 1977. So when he dies, there is this kind of grief that's not just limited to the United States and Memphis. It's actually a global thing. You look at the papers of the time and people are genuinely in shock because this is this big figure. He's only 42 at the time. It's not an old age to be...
Literally a big figure.
Yeah. Well, at that time, it depends. You look at the details, the coffin and things, there's a very
it's weird discrepancies in the death certs and stuff. Anyway, but there is this kind of public fascination, and part of it as well is there was an expose about his life that had just been published. He was very much back in vogue. There was a new album out. He was a figure that had this kind of very significant presence.
And a mythos around him as well.
Exactly, and I think this is the thing about all these figures, is that we've been able to shape each of them depending on, what we want to, actually how we want to feel. And regardless of whether or not those people actually really ever affected your life, we were aware of them. So Diana, we were aware of Jade Goody. Well, Jade Goody got her announcement basically that she was going to die while she was appearing on live TV, which in itself is perhaps the ultimate fulfillment of this entire kind of celebrity death thing. We actually got to watch Jade Goody's death sentence from start to finish. You know, she's in Celebrity Big Brother. She gets dragged out. We know instantly that there is a problem because she's been dragged out, and it's not because she's been racist to Shilpa Shetty. It's because there's something really significant in her life. And then we hear that she's got cancer, and we actually watch her deteriorate and play out her last moments on the screen and in the papers and everything else. And that's fascinating. There's no way we can't say we weren't hooked to that. No. Which is very fitting for someone who came to fame from Big Brother anyway, whose life did play out through this kind of live feed. The interesting figure, I think, that we kind of avoid talking about is Savile.
Oh, yeah, so we can talk about Savile.
When you look at his funeral, when he died, and the kind of...
Golden coffin.
Massive headstones, a lot of prayers, marching through the streets, hundreds of people going to watch him, and this constant emphasis about just how great he was through his charitable work. And to be honest, there were very few people in the country that probably didn't buy into that to some extent. We may have thought he was weird, but we kind of thought that's what we knew about him, that was the public image that was projected.
Did they pull Jimmy Savile's gravestone down? Am I right in thinking that? They got rid of it.
They pulled the headstone down basically because it was going to become a target for the wrong kind of homage. You know, it's not like Oscar Wilde and people kind of kissing the headstone.
If you think about, they get rid of houses where there's been murders because people treat it as like a ghoulish...
Well, Hitler's childhood home, or the Hitler's home they're talking about pulling down now, so it's...
Oh, that's been in the news recently, hasn't it? Yeah.
Does Hitler have a grave?
No, she was burnt and then kind of, well, allegedly burnt and then shoveled off, unless he went to South America and lived out his days in the Copacabana.
And the Copacabana. That's the fourth verse that no one talks about. Robert, you've listened to our historical, cultural and social precedents. We'll just give you a quick reminder. So for historical, we had...
The death of a heartthrob and Rudolph Valentino.
And the Hollywood Forever Cemetery. For cultural, we had The Beauty and the Dead, the embalming of Evita Perón.
And The Show Must Go On and celebrity CGI resuscitation.
And finally, for social, I had The Diana Effect and The Mass Hysteria of Grief. And Miranda had...
Celebrity Death Pools.
What grabbed your interest?
Oh, this is pretty tense.
This is quite difficult because this is an area that I work in a lot. And a lot of this is,
did we tell you anything you didn't know?
There's little bits and pieces here and there. I might ever so slightly... To be fair, it's really close this week. I'm probably going to edge with Miranda slightly.
The Cultural Historian of the Month is Miranda. Gold star to Miranda.
Yay!
Which one swung it for her?
To be honest, it's the special effects.
I think that is a really interesting subject, ethically.
Fascinating.
I'm really looking forward to seeing where that goes.
I mean, you think about yourself. Yes. Do you want somebody to reproduce you guys after you're gone to carry on this podcast?
Absolutely not.
Well, I'm not actually planning on dying.
How are you getting away with that?
No one's used face cream in the same amounts that I do.
There was a point this afternoon when I was... suggesting that it would be good for our publicity if he did die whilst we recorded.
That's really threatening, and I feel you have influenced the guests.
I haven't. Why?
By threatening them with death.
I've given him wine, made sure he's comfortable. Okay, so I think we need to now say thank you very much to our guest, Robert Simpson, for coming along to join us for pronouncing me the winner. Thanks for listening to A Cultural History Of. We'll be back next month with another episode.
You have been listening to The Cultural History Of, presented by Miranda Garrett and Chesky Pechier, produced by Nigel Doyle-Rush with the voice of Trev Fleming.